So as we begin again, I would like to encourage everyone to bring body and mind all together in one place and in the sphere of one's own mind stream. Generate what is your own inherent basic good nature. And from that basic good nature, recognize the radiance of what could be nothing but the powerful aspiration of genuine kindness and compassion that encompasses without bias all sentient beings. Whether you see it from the perspective of all sentient beings having been one's own parent in one life or the other, or whether you recognize simply the very intricate and the multiplicity of the web of interconnections, interdependency that we all share among all sentient beings, with all sentient beings. Based upon the pathway of that codependency, based upon the tremendous amount of sharing, caring, and giving and taking that has happened between oneself and all sentient beings. Reflecting also upon the enormous karma and the interconnectedness of karma that we have with all sentient beings, and particularly being mindful of the karmic debt that one owes to all sentient beings, knowing that everything that we are today, who we are, the build-up of our own personalities with both negativities and also good qualities, everything that we are able to understand in life, recognize in life, obtain in life, being given to us, shared by all sentient beings. And therefore, reflecting upon this immense and close relationship with all sentient beings, recognize how we are all related with one another. And therefore, just as I persevere on the path of practice, recognizing that connection with all sentient beings, may I make sure that that aspiration, which is generated from my inherent basic mind, be filled with genuine love, genuine kindness towards all sentient beings with whom I am connected. May all hearing, contemplating, meditating, and engaging in the path of practices arise as pristine merit, a good cause that then manifests the power of wisdom that illuminates the lives of all sentient beings. And through that, may all be able to obtain freedom from suffering. It is with that single intent that I exert effort. It is with that aspiration that I engage on the path of practice. And it is with this intention, by taking refuge into the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, that I dedicate my life as a Buddhist practitioner. So thinking in this way, as we do the recitation for this morning, Tamji Chambala Chazelo, the Dresanji Jum Dende, the Nishabandra Jumba, Yanda Bertobe, Sanji, Rebadan Shabzu, the Banda, the Reshabanji, the Nishabandra, Woodlwe, Kalo Jumba, Lanam, the Balanam, Jum Dende, so the Nishabandan, Sonam Dagi, Jutum, Bangiwe, Tawanam, Chumizawa, Sobadagi, Rabdo, Jemba, Sonam Ji, Terrenam Ji, Peje, Sambo. Sanam ji me do je ba ji yul ram bra tum ba to nam hi tum ba me ba de pe me ba nam da gum bra ga wa she ra se ji me ne ba to nam lan zo wa me ba sen jen tham ji ji tum ba chan ju san ba nam ji ya pa be ka sa nam ji je bo nyang en de de pe nam ji de pe yi she ba do me ba to wa sam ji me cha ba son nam bra da ba ya ni ba je bo da ve cho mi she ba ko chung ba me ba de ba da ge ma ge ba so da ge ni wa ra ma ge ba so me ba da ge nam bra ro wa phum bo ra le nam to nam bra ro wa kham nam da me de ba chen che nam tham ba de ba nam shin do che ba yong so dong wa da le nam bra ro wa se ba le ro wa cho wo Yishe yungso zoba te pa ta ma jen pa ta ta tar chungwe sanje chum ten ten nam chi yishe la ne pa jangen ten te pa la min ne pa yang ta pa ni che ta la Semjen tamche la sebe sala shubha de te da ne sanje chumden de te ku che ve yun de yang da pa nam su. Tambe chunye tomar gyo parto. Tsidru sambo madre ba yung su, zo ba yung su, da ba yung su, chung wa chumden de chi chue le par sung ba yang da par tong wa ne me ba du che ba me ba nye war de ba de tong wa la du yue ba ke ba nam je su su rang ge re par cha wa chumden de chi su be chue de ba le par nye par chu wa zo be chang chu tun zo war che ba me dun ba me jin de ba dan den ba yu wa chu wa che ba de ba chum be ken dun ne le ba Talma jarve vesu jurva cha jave vesu jurva su nam che pa chi shi yu yung su jang va chim pe ne su jurva kundu ya chim pe ne su jurva chim po san che yun de sam me cha chu chi yun de sam me cha kin de yun de sam me cha bla Nambara mienpang sammi jya namda shindu che prae shu Sanji chudang soji chud namla chanju bardo dhani chasu che Tagi chisu che besu namchi dhola Soji chud namla chanju bardo dhani chasu che Tagi chisu che besu namchi dhola Pinchi sanji chupra shu Sanji chudang soji chud namla chanju bardo dhani chasu che Tagi chisu che besu namchi dhola Chola Benje Sanjin Chobarae Shou Tadang Thaye Simjin Nam Yine Sanjin Yimbala Yimbara Shebe Danyi Do Chajo Chodo Do Simjin Thamjin Dewa Dang Dewe Chodang Dambara Chuchi Dungay Dang Dungay Ji Chodang Chawara Chuchi Dungay Mepe Dewa Dang Minja War Chuchi Nirin Chadang Dang Chawe Dang Yom Chimu Bala Nebara Churae Ji Chaza Wada Chuchi Shabada Jesu Yira Kushi Dagi jesa ba tamje dagi chanjo jemburo go Sashi piji choshi meto chan rirab nishi ninten jemba de Sanje shinto miten burwa yin chokin namda shinta che parai sho Uyi jenran che tao che chung to Che kuro kordo so Uyi jikun riji chupin son to che rang chun chukko ngha che lupin to pekam chong wei nin che katin che Ujian sanje nipar so wa de Tene namda kunja ribi shi Tene chupin poble rab chuk Chume tene nilu ngusum to yung se to che ten la so wa de La sum namda mante nji de me Samme nilu ngunjo na cho cho Kalde kushirin pinze ngha ke wang Chupa jen tui shabla so wa de Namda mula sabi me ba le Pe me tong to dodo lam Chusun riji sezo chen la pa nambara jewe pavara sowa de Rikun chabda pe men cha sabche Osal to jen jimbo yo kong so de Na jo wang chu hiru ka pe chu Tijin kun san wang che tu na che Lama nyam me san che rumbo che Tuzum de che se che tam che che Kusun to che rang shin chen la pa Katin chen pe shabla sowa de Dengi sun de kurwa ma tong war Jewa nam che chen le wang chu Tamen chukun nyan de shirgo pe sim ne Chan chu nambara che che ho So, good morning, everyone. Is there a Sherry here? Because, I mean, she's not here in the morning. Okay, Sherry. And then Simone is supposed to be here. Okay. I'll see you later, Simone. Okay? All right. So, sometimes it's funny with, especially this thing in the front here, the what you call the webcast. You're the webcast person here. Mm-hmm. Two of you. Okay. All good. And then because of this, and then because of also the modern technology, other technologies that are here. So people are sending questions through the internet. Okay. So where I am staying, the internet doesn't work. So I just wanted to make that clear. So, walking up on the road at the night, getting the internet connection is going to be difficult. But some of you have asked a few questions or so forth. So I just wanted to sort of put it all together in this morning's talk a little bit. I don't know whether those of you who are sitting in front of me have questions also. So if you have questions, feel free to raise your hands and ask. It is very important that interaction does happen in the context of Buddhist teachings. I'm sure many of you know, but today, as the world changes and we find more different kinds of advancements in technology happening, there's a lot of merit in that, there's a lot of goodness in that, that the outreach, especially in the context of the lifestyle that is there today, I think it's very, very beneficial. One does often wonder how it would be if we were able to have a webcast during the times of our Shakyamuni Buddha, beginning from Shakyamuni Buddha to Padmasambhava to all the great masters of the various lineages. That things would be very different. Sometimes one wonders. But then often again, one thinks, no, this stubborn mind is going to be stubborn, was stubborn 2,500 years ago, still is stubborn. So yes, life would continue. But of course, one does sometimes think about a whole lot of work that could have been archived, that could have been gathered, that could have been preserved with a much more sense of directly receiving the teachings if such technologies were there at that time. However, as I was saying, the stubborn mind, just as hard as our skull over here, and much more harder than that, is the stubbornness of the human mind. And the path of Buddhist teachings is all about how to take that stubborn mind that really wants to be flexible in many ways, but still resists doing it because it enjoys. It enjoys the pleasures, it indulges, and the entertaining quality of even the pain and the suffering is so much there. Sometimes the sort of psychological approach of our human mind is such that more than happiness, we are entertained by suffering. And so the sort of pleasure that we take in pain, the pleasure that we take in not having something, the pleasure that we take in being blamed, the pleasure that we take in not obtaining, is far more enticing to the mind than getting something. For example, preparation for your weekend getaway is often more entertaining than the actual experience of that getaway or weekend or break or holiday or whatever it is. If you observe, even in children, it's the prelude to whatever it is that you are trying to get that seems to be more exciting to the mind than the actual getting it. When your parents don't give you that new gadget, when you can't get that new, what for is that? You have all the ratings, 3G, 4G, I don't know, 5G, second year. There is 5G yet or not? No. 4G. So even among the monastics, sometimes the monks and the nuns, there's a lot of discussion about all the latest developments. And so I keep asking them, what is the difference? Last year also, this thing that you have, now you're wanting another one. What is the difference between 3G and 4G? I think I asked that last time. I don't remember whether it was 2 and 3 or 3 and 4. But then they said, it's faster. So then, you know, for someone like me, really not so good in technology, whatever we have now is fast enough for me. I can't follow that much. Now something even more faster than that, but we always like it. So when you're traveling in subway, you look at somebody who has now 4G. And then immediately the mind begins to begin that prelude to what you don't have. And then the process of trying to get more, so that wherever you cross, now you don't see the normal things that you see. You only see 4G everywhere. The new things, the new products, the new obtaining of sources of what we imagine to be happiness, those come into production. So we focus upon that. So even in what we don't have, there is a bit of entertainment. The prelude to trying to obtain that, it's very enticing. It's very, very entertaining. So although it is something that really, if we define in terms of what emotions are defined as anger, jealousy, competitiveness, or not having happiness, or wanting to something, or being blamed for something, or being felt or feeling left out, isn't sort of a good experience that we aspire. But nevertheless, there is this enormous entertainment and the flavor, the very, what we call the spicy flavor of the entertainment, in such that we get drawn to it, and therefore it's something that really allows the mind to begin to become more and more self-absorbed in that particular entertainment. So when mind begins to continually sort of be persuaded by all of these different tendencies of the mundane world, the different kinds of happinesses, basically the eight worldly dharmas, whether it is happiness, there's a lot of trying to pursue happiness that preoccupies our mind and our concentration a great deal. Whatever little time that we are able to get from the pursuit of obtaining happiness is in the pursuit of what we think is not happiness, trying to escape from it. But even in that trying to escape, be free from suffering and pain, there is this entertainment which I just spoke about. Then there is hope and there is fear. There is obtaining, there is not obtaining. There is praise, there is blame. There is becoming something significant. You are very significant to somebody, to your own self, or you assume you are very significant, to the moments where others or situations lead you to feeling and seeing yourself as very insignificant, the very contrast, the opposite of feeling very important. So all of these tendencies of what are called eight worldly dharmas keep us very entertained. And while that entertaining quality continues to be very strong in our mind, how can you tame such a mind? Because it stubbornly believes all of these to be very important. The stubbornness is not just a of course it's an egoistic stubbornness, but the stubbornness is fed, it is nourished, and it is nourished by all of the eight worldly dharmas. So as long as these continue to be the neuroses, the disturbing emotions that what we are talking about, continue to feed the rigidity, the tightness, the inability to be able to have, yesterday afternoon we talked about an expansive, more expansive and a resilient view, then the tightness and the rigidity, the stubbornness continues. Now that stubbornness and rigidity has to be broken. And I'm not sure how far it can be broken by keeping distance between self, the teacher, and the practices. So, all of the, for example, people who are hearing webcast. So as far as understanding or hearing the words, then that's very good. But now you have to understand it correctly when I use the word, because in English, and especially the way you all see it, there are certain words that you all don't relate very well to. One is what I call whack or spank. Now, many people get a little bit startled by that because you think, no, this is not allowed. Physical beating is not allowed. I agree with that. But teachers must be able to and be allowed to whack the student. I don't necessarily mean physically. But how would you otherwise break that stubborn rigidity which we continually let persist in our own attitude and our own conduct? So, for example, those of you who are sitting in front of me, at least sit straight. Or have been sitting straight. No, you all sit straight. There's a, you know, what I'm not talking about is just a posture. It is about, there's a little more exertion. You know, you feel asleep, but you try to hold your mind back. You're very tired, but you don't necessarily leave the room. Temperatures may not be very suitable to your physical texture or the sense of texture, but you exert an effort. You want to yawn loudly, you don't do that. Isn't it? If your mind is coming up with a lot of thoughts, you keep quiet. That's discipline. That's immediately training yourself. Now, those of you who are behind a computer screen, I have no idea what you're doing. So you're left on your own. Vajrayana Buddhism is working with this concept. The whole concept of transforming emotions, working with your own self. Ultimately, when we engage in Dharma, when we engage in any path of practice, what you are conveying is a message that says, here is a person willing to work with one's own mind. One would not talk about disturbing emotions, recognizing them to be negative, and wishing them to be dissolved or sort of subjugated, if one did not clearly understand that this required taming the mind, transforming oneself. Now, where transforming one's own nature from an impure, tainted, mistaken, fabricated state to its purer and true fundamental nature is the process of the path of practice. That is what the path of practice entails. Then you have basically two choices. And Vajrayana says that. Up until the outer Mahayana teachings, the emphasis is in self-discipline. And so in some ways, Hinayana and Mahayana practitioners also work a lot with self-discipline. You are your own teacher. Your own analytical meditation, your own ability to have the discerning wisdom strengthened through the hearing, contemplation, meditation, and particularly the examination, and giving strength and power to the logical mind, that which understands emptiness, nature of self and phenomena, that which is able to have a glimpse of the fundamental nature beyond everything else that is constructed, built up, fabricated by one's own misunderstandings of what we think is there but is actually not there. When that process becomes more strong, then it gives birth to logical interpretation. So, Madhyamika teachings or the Prajnaparamita teachings, understanding the emptiness nature, gives birth to logical perspective. Not logical in any other sense other than that it begins to see things as they truly are. And that destroys the buildup of assumptions and presuppositions with which we mistakenly continue to live life, and that is which is called a state of ignorance. So when the logical mind that sees things, deducts, analyzes, and sees things clearly comes about, then you do have an inner power, a natural ability to be so alert that it is able to withstand all that what may be false concepts, presuppositions, and mistaken beliefs that we sometimes succumb to. In such a case, one doesn't need to have any kind of dependence on anyone else. So Shravakas and Pratyeka Buddhas rely upon that. Solitary realizers, also all of the Hinayana practitioners rely upon that. Mahayana Buddhists also rely upon that. But from the perspective of Vajrayana teachings, or what is called the inner or secret Mahayana teachings, then Samvetthepa Chembe Lam, as we say, the secret Mahayana path of practices, however, begins to have a further recognition of the stubborn attitude of the person. And we think, yes, while that natural propensity of being inseparable from the logical, realized wisdom mind is a possibility, yet am I able to really have that kind of a potential? Would I still not be in a better situation by having some correction given to me? And so somewhat the path of Vajrayana that stresses devotion. devotion to the teacher or devotion to the practice, whichever way it may be, is this approach of saying, yes, where I could cultivate strong self-discipline, but if I know myself correctly, am I able to really do it? And clearly distinguishes between a potential and a possibility, what is immediately possible. In our immediate possibility, then, what seems to be more strong in one's own self? The attraction towards the eight worldly dharmas that we talked about, the entertainment of hope and fear, of praise and blame, of suffering and happiness and suffering, of obtaining, not obtaining, gain and loss, of being praised or of being relegated to a state of insignificance. All of these things still matter to you or do not matter to you. If getting happiness doesn't matter to you, if encountering suffering doesn't matter to you, and you are somewhat like a true Mahasiddha and a yogi, good things happen, you're just as happy. Bad things happen, you're just as happy. Single taste, one taste. One doesn't succumb to or is attracted to the powerful manifestation of hope and fear. So whether hope or whether fear, one is able to never lose the balance of awareness. Someone praises you, nothing happens. Someone blames you, nothing happens. You are someone very important. You are really insignificant to everyone. No one even realizes you're existing. Doesn't matter to you. So if one is able to be so single-pointedly able to see the true nature, and that's what the logical mind sees, the true nature of self and phenomena, and such as our great bodhisattvas and masters are able to have a uniform state of mind that is vast in its abiding in state of equanimity, free from bias and partiality, free from being persuaded by the highs and lows of different kinds of appearances as we experience. Such a mind, if one has, then there is, as I said earlier, less dependency. But is my mind like that? Is my mind different when it is in front of somebody? Is my mind different from behind the computer screen? Do I see things differently? Do I say things differently? Do I react differently? How much of the self-discipline, self-control, I truly have? When one takes into perspective of reflection this state, then one also finds how important it is to then relate to what has eventually in these, especially the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, the 1200 years of Vajrayana Buddhism, how much form has actually come into our path of practice. And all of these forms are therefore necessary. The body has the potential to sit still. Does it ever do that? The speech has the potential to be silent. Really, this world does not need any one of us to chatter so much. But do we become silent? It actually takes for you to go to a beautiful Zen center before you begin to sit still and be quiet, isn't it? And so that tradition becomes very valuable. It becomes extremely important to learn to see what true path of training one's body, speech, and mind is. And then mind, that we from day one as a Buddhist practitioner know, is generating countless of those thoughts, and most of them, if not all of them, being simple hope and fear, suppositions, assumptions, none of them that actually will happen. So therefore, we could really have more time and more space and more ease and relaxation within our own self if one were to able to realize not to follow, not to be so giving into the entertainments of the mind and the mental imaginations, that the mind could actually rest and be at ease, be still. But do we let it be? So where body cannot sit still, verbally we cannot be quiet, silent, mentally the mind doesn't seem to rest without constantly doing the three things: following thoughts of the past, thinking thoughts of the future, and trying to grapple the present and being very unsuccessful at that. Beyond these activities of the mind, there's nothing really that intelligent that we are doing at this time. Where this is the condition with which we then begin to walk the path of the great aspiration of transforming our mind, taming our own mind, then one recognizes how important it is to bind it to the pillar of concentration, to the pillar of mindfulness. So the disciplines of sitting in meditation, the disciplines of recitation and being quiet, the disciplines of various forms that allows the mind to be engaged in a pillar of support, that allows it to then slowly familiarize itself, first introduce itself to the fact that it doesn't have to be so volatile at all times in order to be alive. Then you begin to actually recognize that that is true. The introduction leads to recognition. And the recognition has to be supported and generated or combined together with familiarity. So when you come to a state of familiarity which appeases the tension that supposes that without your interference, things won't function, this world will not begin to make good sense of how it can run in its axis without my input. So we almost begin to think, well, if I don't say something, do something, think something, interfere in some ways, sun will forget to rise from the east. And then there will be great confusion if the sun forgets to set. How will people know how to become alive? How will people know how to live life? How will my family even make sense of who they are if there is not me who has to bring in the input of constantly reminding who they are, what they should be doing? So we make ourselves very, very important. And so I always think, you know, that's how I learned myself. Years ago, now I don't do that. Years ago, when I started first traveling, then all of our monks and nuns, especially the nuns, were all younger people at that time. So whenever I would travel, I would almost think, how are they going to manage without me? So constantly, wherever you are, back in your mind, there's always a big thought. Now they're going to make a mess of everything. Now they're going to not be able to raise this correctly. They're not going to be able to do this correctly. So you constantly interfere, constantly give your input, constantly worry about it. However, after years of going back, finding they're very happy without me. They do very well. They've managed very well. They actually do better when you're not there. Then you begin to really think, well, it's mostly, now whenever I say this, people always say, no, you're very important. That's their love. That's their attachment. But beyond that, if you take the same example as being alive and how important your being alive is in the lives of the others. Now out of attachment, beyond the emotional attachment and love, yes, of course, we think, if I think, oh, my parents are very important, my teachers are very important, you are very important, I am very important, cats and dogs are very important, they shouldn't die. But the reality of death is extraordinary. If it is a very well-loved person, then maybe it lasts, the loss lasts about 2 weeks, 3 weeks. Of course, few people suffer greatly. Then you hang a picture, and have you noticed? Even in the case of great teachers, great leaders of the world, first there is tremendous attachment. You almost cannot imagine life without them. Then they die. Then the picture hangs very prominently everywhere.
With passage of time, one picture hangs. With more passage of time, the picture begins to become sort of in the wrong place. So you move it to a wall that is less significant. More passage of time, it ends up in the attic. And with more passage of time, a garage sale that this area seems to be very, very famous for. And somebody walks up and doesn't even know. Oh, the frame I could use. Isn't it? But while being alive, we think, oh, this is the beginning. That's how I think. That's how each one of us thinks. And that's the significance of what we think, of what we believe to be very important. And so long as that kind of an importance, that kind of a significance, that kind of solidification is built up in one's own self, that mind needs to be transformed. That mind needs to then let go of attachment, let go of desires, let go of ignorance, let go of anger. Transforming emotions, therefore, the root, as we talked about yesterday, comes down to the self-cherishing attitude, the self-importance, self-absorption that is there. But for that to go through a transcendence, it will have to cultivate humility. It will have to let go of being able to go beyond things that are very comfortable to the self-absorption, because that is what conceals. The wisdom conceals and makes it sort of more overpowered and succumb to all the false concepts. And therefore, the breaking down of that rigidity, the breaking down of all the walls that we create, does require the importance of all the forms of the practices, and particularly the teaching and the teacher's role becomes very important. So this morning, as I began with interaction, the interaction is very important. In your lives, building a relationship where Dharma doesn't become a lecture that one listens to and likes here and there, but it becomes powerful enough that either you are training yourself or you allow somebody else, powerful, what you can place your trust in to bring about that transition and change. Also, another very important thing in that perspective is also the analysis and the observance of one's own attitude and conduct. So this is where we stopped yesterday, is bringing about a strong amount of observance, watchfulness in one's own self that reads yourself better, that is able to know yourself better, knows all the very subtle tendencies of slyness and deception that it can so very easily bring, that will help consolidate and retain habitual patterns and the impulses of habitual patterns, has to be seen in one's own self. That requires questioning. Questioning the way you do things. Questioning the way you make decisions. Questioning the way you are approaching situations and circumstances. If immediately the questioning is not there, and upon that questioning you find an answer, and the answers are carrying the weight of Dharma, not the Dharma convenient to you, but the Dharma that is given to you, the truth of the Dharma must become potent enough to be able to bring the answer that better assists the discerning wisdom, the prajna intrinsic of one's own self. So questions will come. You have to bring up those questions. The response to the questions that allow you to then make a better decision, that allow you to approach a situation with more sanity than succumbing to the neuroses and the kleshas, the negative emotions, such as when you confront an aggravating situation and you observe in your own self and you think, oh yes, now I am feeling temper arising in my own self. What do I do? Then the answer must carry the weight of, you are, you know, sort of saying, you cannot even ask that question. What else would you do but be patient? What else would you do but generate compassion? Because you are the holder of the Dharma. You've heard the teachings. If you succumb to retaliation with more aggression at this moment, it would be seemingly that you would never, or you have never heard the words of the Dharma. So here then, the pondering and the examination doesn't remain so much the immediate moment of aggravation, but the context changes to how strong is your refuge anyway? How strong is your commitment anyway? With what kind of an intention did you generate the bodhicitta? What level of realization of emptiness nature of thoughts did you actually think? So your question leads to, what were you doing in meditation a few minutes ago? If you were seeing that as, oh, the compositeness of many different factors and, you know, elements and aggregates and all the different kinds of ayatanas that are coming together, and therefore essentially emptiness is in nature, omanipimeho, you know, and you love green Tara and you love Chirisi and you love the Shakyamuni Buddha and so forth. So what were you doing? If you just walked out of a shrine room having recited 10 malas of the Mani mantra or any other mantras, then here the end result of it is that you're even coming up with the question, what should I do here? There is no question. You need to be nothing but kind, nothing but tolerant, patient. One must question, one must answer, one must look into one's own self and approach arising situations from the perspective of Dharma. So when the sort of focus of things, or how you focus on things, the articulation of decisions, how you actually perceive what you encounter, when that focus itself carries more the flavor of a Dharma perspective, then you are building a greater possibility of taming your mind, transforming your mind. But despite the weight of books and texts and paraphernalias of Dharma that you carry with you, let's say, you know, all of you have those huge backpacks wherever you go. And so if you look into it, there are all your Dharma paraphernalias in there. Prayer books, mala, bell and ghanta if you are a Vajrayana practitioner, everything that you might need in a session of meditation, you carry with that too. So despite the weight of all of the Dharma objects that you carry with you, and then if there was only a scale which could weigh the number of teachings and books you have read of Dharma, then how many kilos, how many pounds would that be? Those are the weight that you carry with you. Despite the weight of Dharma that you carry with you, nevertheless, if the perspective with which you look into each situation remains mundane, you're articulating a situation mundanely. The thought process remains mundane. The decisions you make and the approach you take to interpreting a circumstance remains mundane. Then, other than having carried tremendous amount of weight like a mule who carries a heavy load, mind doesn't go through the change and the transition. So here what is essential is that the changes from the negative to the positive emotions, in order for that to happen, the mind has to begin to educate itself to look at things in a much more clearer way. And the clearer way is to be able to approach things with a magnitude of a wider perspective of seeing everything, all causes and conditions that bring about a situation where there is no one particular thing to praise, neither is there one particular thing to blame, neither is there one thing to obtain, neither is one thing not to obtain. But the perspective, the sort of vastness of the perspective, allows a greater approach of more relaxed approach, or approach of greater resilience and tolerance to whatever that you are approaching. So that when you look at anger, you look at it from Dharma perspective, not the samsaric perspective. When you're looking at selfishness and the arousing of the selfishness or desire, you're looking at it from a Dharma perspective. When you have laziness, distraction, and turmoil of many different disturbing emotions, you're able to look at it from a Dharma perspective, not the worldly perspective. And that Dharma perspective is what we are building up. All the practices that you are doing, all the learnings that you are doing, especially the mindfulness that you are generating, is the Dharma perspective. When the Dharma perspective is what begins to look at things, then you're able to relate to situations as they arise from a different perspective. But in not doing so, instead, when you encounter situations, you deal with them from the same habitual ways of dealing with them, then there is very little benefit, because in that moment of dealing with it with the same habitual ways, the mundane samsaric ways, you've actually sort of brought yourself to a situation where you've allowed yourself to forget teachings, your refuge, your commitment, your devotion at that very crucial moment when it is most needed. So one of the emails yesterday talked about being in retreat and then encountering past emotions and how to deal with it. As I said in the first day, emotions are general and you cannot categorize them as those emotions when I'm not in retreat and those emotions that I am in a retreat. Basically, you're carrying them and they're in the framework of your own mind. So how you deal with them is the same way you would deal with anything else. And most importantly, you deal with your emotions. The best way to deal with them is what you would advise another person to deal with them, how to deal with them. So how others deal with them, how I deal with them is the same. How I deal in the daytime, how I deal at nighttime is the same. How I deal with them when they are very significantly strong in front of me or when they are somewhat just a very faint memory in my mind is the same. And so in this context, what we are talking about is the sort of generation of the Dharma perspective. What is the true nature of that thought that you are giving rise to? And particularly in our case as meditators, then allowing even those feelings and thoughts and emotions, those particularly the harder emotions, the painful emotions, which we have retained over a period of time, to also be brought forward when you think about the emptiness nature of phenomena or of thought, where you are really able to examine and see how much of everything that we are bringing. Yesterday we talked about the anger or the ignorance or the desire or any of the 20 afflictions, how much of those are creations, projections, subsidiary branches of the self-cherishing attitude, then within that are also the very subtle, difficult, painful experiences which must be brought forward, whether they are of abuse, whether they are of great injustice done to you, painful experiences that you have encountered in your life. And so when we talk about grudge, then there are, in that context of examination, you have to include a grudge that you might have in the future. We always think about it in this way. Letting go of grudge, we think, yes, grudge is a negative affliction, one of the 20s. And if in the future I have a grudge, then I have to see that as also fabricated by my mind, self-cherishing mind. But in that kind of an examination, perhaps sometimes there may be subtler, similar kind of experiences that we have, that which we are unable to let go of at that moment, and it makes and becomes very important that you bring that in at this time and question, as difficult as it might be, but question, how is the teaching that explains a thought to be a construct of one's own mind? If it is true, then how is that truth not applicable to this very subtle feeling, however, that I'm going through? Take, for example, strong attachment. Attachment is a construct of mind. It is as big as you make it. So I always say, take a balloon, start blowing into it. Blow, blow, keep blowing, it'll get bigger and bigger. Thoughts are like that. You keep blowing into it, you keep blowing into it. It'll remain and it'll grow bigger and it will explode like the balloon in your face if you continue to persist. And so in the same way, if that is the nature of all thoughts, of all attachments, then this subtle attachment that I have for this person, because of which the mind becomes so sunk, so drowned in that subtle attachment, fortified and protected by all reasonings, and carefully so hidden, so well concealed, that when it comes and resurfaces, since I have contained it, since I have cherished it for so long, of course it will resurface. Occasionally when it does resurface, then how strong it becomes, how dominating it becomes. So strong, so dominating, that even on a bright sunny day, I'm never able to see any sunshine but the darkness of being submerged in that attachment or in that aggression. So how is that strong attachment not applicable here at this moment of examination? If someone has abused me, if someone has done me great wrong, and I hold that pain, maybe without the anger, but of self's individual pain and hurt that one has, how is that pain, how is that hurt not applicable to the examination here? How is that different from the 20 afflictions? And so you personalize. And this personalizing of the emotion, seeing it, having the strength and the courage to address that issue, addressing it without falling into the two extremes. An immediate impulse is to find a reason. There's no need to reason an affliction. An affliction is an affliction. Done to you, it is an affliction. Done to others, it is an affliction. Done by you to others is an affliction. Done by others to you is an affliction. And therefore, being able to have the courage to see and address it as an affliction, as a negative emotion. But beyond that, then having greater strength to apply the same examination, and particularly here, taking a step forward from what we spoke about yesterday afternoon, the observance must then not only be a kind of a passive observance, but the observance now must be more into a correction, a sense of really combining it with the wisdom to release, to let go, with the intimate recognition that it will be there as long as you hold on to it. And so when in the teachings, particularly the Vajrayana teachings, most of the transcendence path of emotion, how to transcend emotions, comes with the single one instruction, let go, don't grasp. Now, letting go is not going to be so possible by anything, but only will happen when you are able to release it. And when you will release it is up to you. So the time is up to you, and you determine it. No matter how well we hide it, no matter how well we keep it, no matter how many reasonings we may defend with it, and the other extreme is negating it. While one reasons and finds reasons why you must have it, the other extreme is almost negating the presence of even such a problem. Without doing that, without underestimating the power of those subtle experiences, neither overestimating its need and its necessity, but having the clarity of insight of coming to that very crux of the matter, as they say, when it's between your holding and your letting it go. That will determine how much that is going to continue its prolonging effect in your own mind, or when you are able to let go. And so In that observance and watchfulness of one's own attitude and conduct, the most important thing is to defeat, perhaps, even in the context of the 12 Nidana teachings. One talks about the third Nidana, the consciousness, and the imprint that the consciousness carries of the impulses. What Vajrayana tries to work with is to work with this third Nidana perspective. Is impulses are there, but you store the impulses. There are two facets to it. When we talk about mind or consciousness, we talk about a consciousness that is the slave. Yesterday we used this term, slave to the impulses. It continues to adhere to the impulses of reacting the same ways. This morning we used the term samsaric perspective. So the samsaric perspective would be letting the impulses continue, reacting in the most predictable way that you know how to react. And so that is the continuation, and that is when we say the mind continually creates causes and conditions. So it's continually creating emotions. But beyond that, there is a storehouse, what we can call, in the context of the Nidanas, one often refers to the very storehouse of consciousness, where the very sort of a numb supposition that it must be retained is there. The storehouse of all the database gathers to a single supposition, and that supposition is that, yes, this makes sense. Holding makes sense. Grasping makes sense. Predictable neurotic impulses and giving into it makes sense. And so the very base of the mind retains an imprint that doesn't allow it to be really let go of. Acute observance, when you're really mindful, when you're really looking at your own mind and how it begins to exaggerate, how it begins to immediately blow up a situation. And at the same time, if one is able to bring in a much more Dhamma perspective, and the Dhamma perspective is doing what is not predictable. At that moment is whatever can be exaggerated, diffusing by non-participation, diffusing that by non-interference, diffusing that by stillness, diffusing it with silence, diffusing it with non-thought, or simply not chasing after thoughts. When these three antidotes of stillness, silence, of really emptying the mind from chasing after, grasping and craving, then that unpredictable sort of antidote allows one to then create strengthened spiritual or Dhamma way of relating to things, a Dhamma perspective. That breaks the pattern. When that breaks the pattern, then the storehouse begins to get the first cracks. And the stability and the sort of consolidation of its supposition that it is there. Something needs to be cherished. Something needs to be sustained. The self-grasping, self-absorption needs to be strengthened, begins to diminish, begins to actually become what we call dethroned. So if you've placed self-cherishing, that there is a self that needs to be adhered to, upon a throne, just as you have a coup and you dethrone somebody, you put that person out of power, in the same way, you begin to then dethrone the supremacy of the self-cherishing attitude. There, then, when that is then able to, when you begin to see that the very basic notion that there is a self that needs to be cared for, that needs to be cherished, isn't actually what you have been supposing to do, freedom from that supremacy of the self-cherishing attitude needs to be given birth. When that is then able to be done, then you cut the limbs, you cut the branches. Immediately or spontaneously or automatically, the cutting off the branches of all the afflictions happen. So then there is no need to run after all the different kinds of emotions. chasing after each of the emotions. Because sometimes we think so. We think, oh, when anger comes, what should I do? Then when desire comes, now what should I do? Now if laziness comes, what should I do here? This way of looking singular towards all emotions and from a singular perspective and dealing with them as if each one of them are very distinct, then makes it very endless. Because in every given moment, if you have the capacity of generating, what, more than 80,000 emotions, or if the mind goes through 60 variations per point second, then you have your hands full. As it is, you have 60 emotions in a minute, then you have 60 antidotes on top of that. Each of these 60 antidotes won't come easily, so you'll have to chase after each of them. That's a lot of work to be done in a moment, isn't it? So scatteredness and almost feeling frustrated at not being able to change yourself, to tame and transform your mind, and the discouragement happens. Because here you have been sidetracked into believing that each emotion is individual, that each emotion is separate. How are they separate? What is the true nature of anger other than a self-cherishing attitude? What is attachment and desire other than self-cherishing attitude? What is laziness, dullness, ignorance, torpor, distraction or disturbance? It is self-cherishing attitude. What is the nature of jealousy other than being a self-cherishing attitude? What is arrogance, ego and pride other than a self-cherishing attitude? No matter how subtle it may be, no matter how gross it may be, all of these different facets, different kinds of emotions are all gathered into the single one essence, single one sort of core or basis, which is none other than self-cherishing. So if you look at the word self-cherishing, cherishing we understand. You cherish with a lot of concentration and care. But the cherishing is the verb attached to the self. So you have to say, if I am cherishing something so much, what is it? What is it that you're trying to adhere to? What is it that you're trying to work for? Whom are you trying to here keep on the throne and give all the power to? The self. And so what is that? And so when one explores from this perspective of seeing the or believing in something that never really existed in the first place, then one does begin to understand what the Buddha meant when he talked about ignorance as the cause of suffering. Not because of any other reason, but an absolutely sane person, holder of the precious human existence, lives an entire life adhering to the demands and the expectations of that which doesn't even exist in the first place, other than in the realm of one's own imagination. And so not only does one live an entire life in such a way, but in the process of living in such a way, one creates limitless creation of causes and conditions that inflict one's life and the lives of the others. So, therefore, thinking in this way, this is then the Dhamma perspective that must be brought into one's own life. It is not a thought to be had once in a while. But this is the thought that must be prevalent in all your decisions, in all what you encounter, in all those moments when you interpret whatever you encounter. When you find yourself in the midst of laughter, this is how you have to look at that. When you find yourself in the midst of not obtaining what you want to obtain, this is how you have to look at. When you're in the midst of being praised for something and you find your pride arising, this is how you have to bring in. This insight is what you have to bring in, and you have to interpret that relationship to that moment from this Dhamma perspective. If the Dhamma perspective is strengthened and you're able to look at it more objectively, more pervasively for what all things come together to build up, that situation happens, you relax into that moment. You do not enjoy. There's a double negation here. You do not enjoy being praised, but you do not let the praise become the biography of your life. You do not prolong it to such a degree that 20 years from today, you'll still walk into a room looking to relive that moment again. Not to that degree. At that moment, when you encounter blame, you do not, I'll use the same word, enjoy that blame. You will feel the pain. You will feel the injustice. And that's all right to do so. But the perspective of samsara will be, is to drag that for many thousands of more moments, more longer than it was intended or needs to be. And the Dhamma perspective is being able to live, encounter, and be done with. That's what non-grasping or letting go is. Not grasping to neurotic emotions will in the beginning be very difficult if you think of it as not being touched by them at all. As long as your relative corporeal body exists and you have senses intact and you're going to think, you will feel emotions. But short-lived, the Dhamma perspective way of looking at the emotions allows the lifespan of that encounter be short-lived, be felt, but not dragged on and on into an exaggerated momentum that is eventually going to become much more bigger than it is or it was intended to be or it needs to be. And so that kind of sort of observance cultivated in one's own life, developing a much more or sort of supported by all the teachings and learning and the disciplines that you cultivate, allows one's view of the Dhamma. And this Dhamma perspective is the view of the Dhamma. Whether the view is of emptiness, whether the view is of compassion, whether the view is of a vigilant mind that refuses to be attracted or seduced by the negative impulses, whether the view is of Hinayana, whether the view is of Mahayana, whether the view is of a Vajrayana perspective of seeing emptiness, whatever the view is, but that view must encompass that moment as you encounter and as you articulate. So when one is able to relate to and articulate and make decisions based upon an articulation of the view of the Dhamma, then all of the dominating factors of the negative emotions begin to diminish. And then not doing so is then you have the Dhamma, as I said earlier, but when encountering the difficulty, when encountering the emotional difficulty directed towards you or if you are projecting to them, if there is no sense or presence of the teachings and what you have understood from the teachings, then you will begin to spread everything out and everything becomes very solid, very external. And that is where then we begin to sometimes even have such questions as to how to deal with anger. One may, for example, sometimes we go through a whole teaching on how to transform emotion, and then somebody raises the hand and then they say, how do I deal with anger? So that's a clear moment where we are still looking at something as different from everything else. And that's a wrong way to look at it, because all emotions are connected to the self-cherishing attitude. The best way to overcome each of the negative emotions is to be able to really see the importance or the non-importance of the self-cherishing attitude. What do you think it is? As long as the self, dominance of the self-cherishing attitude, importance of me, the attachment, self-absorption of the self continues, then it will always call in what it feeds upon. And what it feeds upon are all the negative emotions, all the negative tendencies. Therefore, as a practitioner engaging in vigilance, the vigilance being strengthened by mindful observation, the mindful observation being further supported by the view of the Dhamma, the view of the Dhamma allowing oneself to become more acutely in tune or inseparable with the realization of the true nature of the self becomes important. Now this must be taken to meditation, knowing, especially in our cases or in our lives, knowing the nature of emptiness, of thoughts and emotions, from an intellectual perspective that we have most often times, may not be strong enough. Therefore, one must give oneself more time and more space to become familiar to the very fundamental core nature where such a thing as existent self doesn't exist. And so what is the nature of mind? How should a meditator abide more and more in that pure basis which doesn't have or require anything that needs to be grasped or exaggerated to? From the perspective of engaging in meditation to working with your own mind, foremost of all is for the self-cherishing attitude to be weakened, to know how small it is, how small, actually very tiny, that self is in comparison to everyone else that is there. Self-cherishing attitude often believes it to be so important, so significant, as I said earlier, that it imagines that the entire universe actually functions because it exists. To reverse that thought into thinking, that's not true. Rather, one is part of the whole. Not the whole dependent upon this one single part. And so the perspective in one's own mind in meditation must be in thinking, what do I think? Everything exists for me? Or am I part of this existence? How does it look like? And allowing the mind to really look at, oh yes, I have made myself more important than it actually is. And where the self-importance has been sort of a thought allowed to becoming more strong, then demands, of course, become more and more. If you look at, we say in Tibetan, if you are sitting on a cushion 2 feet by 2 feet, that's the space you have. The person next to you gets up and goes away. What do? We put our bag on that cushion, isn't it? Then the person in front of you moves away. You stretch your leg there. Then the person behind you moves away, and then you go down like this. If you had a cushion or a pillow before. What we are trying to say is you take more space as you get more space. Ego-cherishing mind is like that. It gives in to one demand, it asks for two. The demand increases. It never is able to be satiated. So as the sort of tendency of belief that the self-cherishing attitude has to be sustained, you are important, I am important, grows, demands grow. The demands when met, the demands increase. And that's how then it begins to become very dominating in our own minds. To be able to realize that, to be able to see these subtle tendencies within our own selves. And therefore, in order to counteract this, the first preliminary to meditating, in really resting the mind in non-self-cherishing attitude, or to letting go of the self-cherishing attitude, to be able to rest the mind in its own true essence, requires one to feel part of the whole. That feeling part of the whole is then emphasized in the generation of the aspiration of bodhicitta. Why do all the teachings in the Mahayana tradition always begin with the same emphasis of seeing all sentient beings as your mother? And so all sentient beings, having been our mother or father or whatever it is in one lifetime or the other, is a thought encouraged to be generated so that you would see interdependency, so that you would see the wholeness, the spectrum of all sentient beings to whom we are related to, the part of which we are one part of this whole sort of creation of this whole existence. Therefore, generating a sense of completely recognizing oneself to be interconnected, oneself to be part of everyone, and allowing greater sense of sameness, greater sense of connection to be cultivated is important. Throughout the tradition of Mahayana, both in its outer perspective and inner perspective, or what is called relative Mahayana and absolute Mahayana, or generation of bodhicitta, the emphasis is in realizing emptiness through which genuine sameness, genuine compassion, altruism can arise. Or the other way, through generation of genuine altruism or compassion, emptiness arising. Seeing both emptiness and compassion actually as the same thing, not two distinct things. So we do talk about union of emptiness and compassion, but even saying union of emptiness and compassion may not be necessary at all. Because when the mind realizes the emptiness nature of the fixation that we have of the existence of self, such a mind becomes nothing but able to really encompass everyone. There's no room anymore for separation. Who you are, what you are, becomes nothing but compassionate. Such a compassion is not active sort of compassion, what we imagine from a very relative perspective, like a nurse compassion, or like a 911 kind of a compassion, that people ring you up and then you go out with all your doctor's kit and you remedify a situation. Very oftentimes we think compassion is very active. Compassion is having to do something, to go somewhere, to satisfy the hunger of somebody, to give something to the others. Are these not compassion? These are compassion. Yes, they are compassion. But greater compassion stems from there no longer being the dominating tendency of separation between the self and the others. A true compassion is where there is nothing but a genuine sense of being able to hold everything in the same light, without bias, without partiality. Therefore, in the Bodhisattvacharya Avatara and similar Mahayana texts, the shadow or the cool shade of a tree or the basis of the earth or the illuminating warmth and radiance of the sun, the cold water that quenches thirst, these are all the metaphors used for bodhicitta or genuine compassion, that which is able to transcend anger, ignorance, desire, jealousy, arrogance, and so forth. Now, why are these metaphors given? It's because it gives us a better understanding of how it is not so much up to you to then plan and strategize how you are going to be compassionate, who you are. Upon the realization of self no longer needing the cherishing, the self itself its empty nature. And therefore there is nothing to hold, nothing that it needs to be cherished with. Especially it does not have any necessity, doesn't need anymore the nourishment of negative emotions. It doesn't need to be protected by pride. It doesn't need to be protected by anger. It doesn't need to be protected by all its demands and expectations being met. When that understanding arises and the self-cherishing attitude falls apart, such a mind becomes like the cool shade of a tree. It's ever-present for whoever may need it, whenever may need it. Not dependent upon your timing and schedule, but whenever and whoever may need it. It doesn't matter whether the person partaking of the shadow lies under it, sits in it, under it, likes it, does not like it. The shade is always ever-present. Like the warmth and the radiance of the sun, it is ever-present. Like the coolness of the river, whoever. Somebody who is there who swims in it, somebody who drinks in it, somebody who urinates there. For the river, it is the same. It is in the same way that the mind remains ever-present in its wakeful state. And it is not deterred by the momentary encountering and the circumstances that arises, that abides, and that ceases in that moment. And so, being able to cultivate that sense of stability of the awareness of the empty nature of the self allows genuine altruism, genuine compassion, pervasive, non-agenda and strategic, non-strategic compassion to arise. That kind of a true bodhicitta is then the most powerful antidote to all negativities. In order that such may be understood, relative compassion is also taught, such that through patience, through the cultivation of generosity, through the cultivation of ethical conduct, through the cultivation of diligence, concentration and mindfulness, through all kinds of activities of having loving kindness, sympathy, compassion, generating towards the others, then again, one may be able to have a severance, what is called through the generation of all the actions of compassion, the disciplines of compassion, one may be able to bring about severance of the ties to the self-cherishing attitude. Being, in simple words, being very kind ultimately leads to the realization of emptiness. Seeing emptiness ultimately leads to being nothing but kind. And so it's the same thing. So where that selflessness, emptiness of the self is understood, you are nothing but kind. In your generation of being nothing but kind, then the pristineness and the absolute pure nature of the kindness at that moment is nothing but realizing the selflessness of the self. Otherwise, it cannot be kind. And so, in meditation, the underlying sort of the basis upon which working with selflessness, maintaining an attitude of selflessness, knowing selflessness, arises primarily by being able to generate altruism, bodhicitta. So all teachings begin with the aspiration of bodhicitta. And that aspiration, when generated, mustn't be so much, as I said, kind of an aspiration of doing good only, but an aspiration of knowing that to be able to fulfill such a doing good aspiration, the journey must begin by giving the self less chances, less space to make its maneuvers of demands and expectations. And so ultimately, it is about working with one's own self. It is being able to see what the true nature of the self is, how much diminishing, how much decreasing of the attitude of self-cherishing can you bring about. Where you work on that, where you build up on that, where you learn that, and you are able to be more and more attuned within that state of awareness, then you are nothing but free from all negativities. You embody nothing but generosity. You embody nothing but genuine kindness, and there are no traces or the overpowering dominance of any of the negative emotions. Such can clearly be seen in the lives of all of our great teachers, all the great masters. They live in the same world. They struggle and they have their challenges of everything that happens within the mundane world, but remain untainted by that. And how does that happen? It's because the lesser and lesser their potential and ability to care, nourish, sustain the self, the greater the potential to be like the sun in the sky, ever-present, brilliant, and forever responsive to everyone that is around them. And so, examples of these great teachers must be kept in the mind. Emulating their examples are very necessary. And perhaps it is with that that I will end the afternoon morning session, is that all of our path of practices, especially the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, remain with all these. You know, if you look around the room and you see all the great masters of the lineage and their painting there, there's a reason why we hang them there. It's not merely an artwork. In the same way, Shakyamuni Buddha's own figure, an object of veneration, is not there to make something, a place, more beautiful or decorated. But each one of them symbolizes an example of having actually accomplished that what we are talking about. Human life is all about imitation. Everything that we do is imitation. People get angry, therefore you imitate that anger. People are selfish, therefore they imitate that selfishness. People are neurotic, we imitate that neurotic. How do you think a child learns to become so neurotic? They are born quite pure. When a child is born and a baby grows, you see the beauty, the innocence of a baby. Then they become teenagers. The age where impressions are most significant. And whom do they impersonate? Whom do they imitate? They imitate what their eyes tell them to imitate, what they hear, what they think, what is an example in front of them, and then blindly we all imitate one another. That's how we have learned how to be angry. That's how we've learned selfishness is important. That's how we've learned, you know. For example, some things are very interesting. You don't own a house, for example. And then you are now planning to buy a house. And then you learn from books and friends and neighbors all the things that you should be looking for in purchasing a house, which involves a lot of suspicion, lot of doubts, lot of hesitations, and we carry that. And a learned person who goes to get something is fully equipped with all the obtainings and the non-obtainings, the fears and the hopes and the praises and the blames and what to get and what not to get and so on and so forth. So the human life, the mind, which is intrinsically pure in its own nature, sees through the senses and the sense doors all of these objects that are there that we are imitating. And that's how we begin to carry the layers of many different kinds of concepts, many of them which are very destructive and unhealthy to self and the others. Now, many of our teachers in Tibetan Buddhist saying, we have a saying, if you must imitate, imitate the better one. So, if the mind continues to be so distracted by forms, sounds, thoughts, then it also makes sense to train the mind, supported by its own impulse, habitual impulse, by emulating the perfect example, taking vows to transform your mind, eliminating the negativities, cultivating the positive qualities, receiving empowerments and transmissions, connecting yourself to different lineages, taking a teacher as your master, as your teacher, from whom you learn. These important methods within the tradition of Tibetan Buddhism, such as the presence of the pictures and the forms of all these great masters, are so that one may allow the senses to then take inspiration, so that if the mind must emulate the teachers. If the mind must emulate thoughts and how to think, emulate the way they think, emulate the way or aspire to emulate the way that they have brought about the practice in their life. Now, having said that, many people then emulate how they talk, how they walk, how they speak, how they get the front row, and so on and so forth. That's not what we are talking about. But what we are talking about is, do you see anger in them? Do you see how they work with anger? Simply because of being great teachers, great masters, that anger doesn't happen for them in this world, that's not happening. They live with the same number of people as we do. They live with the same people as we do. Same highs and lows, same challenges. As our teachers have said, born from the womb of a mother, everyone is the same. Composed of the five skandhas, everyone is the same. Continually working and sort of interacting with the 18 elements, they are the same. But what is very distinct is how much of that, what is compounded, is seen for what it is truly, versus how you group them into one solid self. And so in our lives, as we live, as we have sort of had the great fortune of living with them, one thing that always strikes, having had the opportunity of seeing them, is the sense of absolutely, in plain English, it would be getting along with everyone. sense of just, having the simplest of the interpretation of every situation. Single, smallest of the smallest thing, giving them great joy. Simplicity being appreciated as much as an appreciation is there for the most intricate and the complex. Meeting with each circumstance with a sense of acknowledging the whole rather than just what you would like to focus upon. And so in that way, where the sense of encompassing, the mind really sees the wholeness, the compositeness, the compoundedness of every reality, sense of greater appreciation of the whole, then you are merging with the expanse that is out there. That expansiveness of the mind is able to hold and accommodate things a lot better. When we look at our own minds, we find that that ability to accommodate the whole is very much diminished and decreased because of the demand that it conform to my expectation, to my idea. And that makes us stingy. That makes us very hesitant. That makes us very, very demanding and suspicious of everything that arises. When you relate to the whole world with demand, with expectation, with a pre-planned strategy of how you're going to get things, and then with your own tremendous amount of ideas to which the other has to conform, then the spirit of accommodating the others is so weak, is so small. And of course, that will then give birth to aggression, that will give birth to a lot of expectation. And when expectations are a lot, then the aggression is even bigger. And ultimately, you get so tired of having your expectations and it not being understood by the others that you begin to then have this one very famous phrase that we've begun to use in today's world, "I don't care." And an indifferent attitude comes about. And so you walk down the streets and you find so many good people, but so many people indifferent to the existence of one another. So sustenance of all the negativities are immediately brought about. The buildup of all the negativities becomes even more strong. So in order to defeat that, in order to defeat such, always keep in mind the examples of the teachers, examples of the great ones, emulating them, aspiring to emulate them, and then eventually knowing that it's up to you. It's up to you to keep your mind fully aware of its own fundamental nature. So with that then, I will in the afternoon read through a text section that I said I would do, of Patarambuche's teaching on what is called first, the biography of mind, and then second, how that knowing the mind, one may be able to relate to arising emotions, and so what is called self-liberation of emotions. So I'll just read through that text with a brief explanation in the afternoon session. Then I forgot to ask if you had questions. So if you have questions, let me know in the afternoon or write a small note and keep it here. Okay?